X-29, number 9B.
Second part. While the first part depicts the infinite motherhood sense pervading the whole chapter from its point of view of inclusion, the inclusion of perfection, the second part now depicts this motherhood sense from the point of view of error's exclusion. It shows that through love's inclusion of true creation, false creation is excluded. As I indicated before, this second part, which comprises the exegesis of the second record of creation, is characterized by the combination of truth and mind. It is truth and mind in the sense that the truth of creation uncovers false creation as not. We find here numerous statements to the effect that error's creation, false creation, is the counterfeit of true creation, of truth and mind. For instance, Mrs. Eddy talks about this false record as error's creation, the history of error, the history of the untrue image of God, the record of error, the false view of creation. Falsehood's creation, a picture of error throughout, the lie about creation, the creation of a lie, and so on, all of which are counterfeits of truth and mind. Here is uncovered as not the erroneous universe originating from mist, obscurity, myths, mythology, mythological material energy. In short, this second part teaches us never to believe a lie, but to know the truth about the science of creation. As the first record of creation is scientific and true, any other record of creation must be unscientific and untrue. It is not surprising, therefore, that the second record presents an exact opposite of the first record. Whereas in the first record, creation emanates from within the self-completeness of love, in the second record, creation is depicted of having its origin outside the realm of God. Also, in the first record, creation is explained as coming from above, and in the second record as coming from beneath. Instead of the unity of God and man as illustrated in the first record, the second record presents man as having broken away from deity, and as revolving in an orbit of his own. Science and Health, 5:22, 8-10. It is most essential to see that this second record of creation is not just any wrong notion of evolution, but is the exact opposite of scientific creation. True creation uncovers the claims of false creation, and so each day of the true creation uncovers its counterfeit belief. The second record of creation, which illustrates the story of these counterfeit beliefs, thus presents the same order as the first record of creation, but in a counterfeit sense. Let me show you briefly how the truth of the first record of creation uncovers the claims of creation and banishes them to the land of Nod, to dreamland, to nowhere. The same scientific order, which before was seen to impel true creation to its fulfillment, is now seen to impel the exclusion of false creation and its relegation to the land of nothingness. Here is the story as it unfolds. The light of intelligence, first day, uncovers the erroneous claim that creation starts from mist, mystification, or ignorance, mind. But there went up a mist, is how the second record starts. The firmament of understanding, second day, uncovers the erroneous claim that in creation, spirit and matter mingle, spirit. Adam was formed from the dust of the ground, and the breath of life was breathed into his nostrils. The dry land of definite spiritual understanding, third day, uncovers the erroneous claim that there is sensation in matter, that creation is sinful, soul. Adam was put into the Garden of Eden. The scientific universal system, fourth day, uncovers the erroneous claim that creation is self-governing, independent of God, principle. In his dream, Adam became a creator, bringing forth mankind independently of God. The individuality of eternal fatherhood, fifth day, uncovers the erroneous claim that creation has a beginning and an end, life. Eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil brought death. The consciousness and dominion of perfect manhood, sixth day, uncovers the fact that material creation is illusive consciousness and has the element of self-destruction, truth. Adam was subjected to the soil, and Eve to sorrowful conception. Cain slew Abel and was stamped with the mark of the beast. The perfection of divine motherhood, seventh day, uncovers the fact that material creation is completely shut out from the presence of God, love. Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod, in dreamland. We see that through the truth of scientific creation, the claim of unscientific creation, of creation starting outside the realm of God, is silenced into its native nothingness. The erroneous claim that creation starts from ignorance, mind, that creation is a mixture of spirit and matter, spirit, that creation is sensation in matter, soul, that creation works independently of God, principle, that creation has a beginning and an end, life, is uncovered as false creation, bearing the seed of self-destruction, truth, and therefore never having any part in God, love. Whatever does not generate in the womb of divine love is erroneous creation and is forever excluded from God. Now, what conclusions can be drawn from all this? If God forever gives birth to his own perfect creation, and if this true creation forever excludes any false creation, the fact is quite naturally established that God's creation alone exists, and that it exists because God exists. Thus, we arrive at the great theme of the third part, which depicts life, that which eternally is, as the sole creator and origin of creation. Third part. In the first and second parts, Mrs. Eddy gives an exegesis of the biblical account of creation and shows that interpreted spiritually, it makes sense in every way, that it holds divine authority. Yet, taken in a literal sense, it contradicts the discoveries of natural science, It is therefore quite understandable that natural scientists of the 19th century challenged the correctness and divine authority of the biblical account and elaborated new theories of evolution, basing themselves thereby solely on a materialistic viewpoint. Mrs. Eddy therefore deals with such theories in the third part of Genesis, where she discusses the various theories of creation, the history of evolution, the history of mortal material life, the beliefs of embryonic life, embryology, questions regarding the origin of existence and the starting point of life, propagation, generation, reproduction, multiplication through eggs, germs, buds, and self-division. This whole third part is concerned with the question, where does life come from? What is the cause of life? Where did life start? What is the beginning of life? Which was first, the bird or the egg? While the first part showed the motherhood of God from its point of view of including its own creation, and the second part showed it from its point of view of excluding erroneous creation, the third part now shows the motherhood of God from its point of view of isness, as the one and only being. The lesson of this third part is really that being is, and that this very fact is the only cause, that unless there is being, there is no being. The main theme of this part is that of life and mind, as of life as the sole creator. This combination is brought out in many ways. For instance, we find here that life has no origin outside God, that life has no starting point, that life is the first cause, that life is the cause of all that exists, that life is self-existent and ever-productive. The sense conveyed is that whatever does not start with life is not. Life cannot be created. Life is the very origin of creation. Put briefly, life has no origin. Life is the origin. Let me now show you how, from the point of view of life as the one and only creator, Mrs. Eddy deals with material theories of evolution. Her first subject explains that mind is creative and matter is not creative. She states that the origin of man is not an egg, that so-called material creation is but a product of erroneous thought. God, mind, created man, and he created him as idea. We find here the remarkable statement. In God's creation, ideas became productive, obedient to mind. Science and Health, 544, 3-4. You see, as mind dwells in the realm of creative mind, ideas become productive. Life is thereby always self-sustained. The second subject expresses that spirit is the only creator and brings forth only its own likeness, spirit. It is shown that mind cannot produce its unlikeness, matter, nor can matter produce its unlikeness, mind. Hence, only the likeness of spirit is man. Material personality, the product of materiality, is not this likeness. One gets here a sense of the wonderful order and purity of spirit, that like produces like. The third subject expounds that man is immortal, whereas the belief of mind in and of matter is mortal, soul. This subject brings out very strongly that whatever does not originate in life is mortal and can never be made immortal. The belief that mind originates in matter, or that matter originates in mind, is mortal and must therefore return to dust. Every attempt to raise spiritual life through an improvement of the belief of life in matter is the condemnation of mortals to till the ground, and is bound to fail. Every attempt to raise an immortal out of a mortal is hopeless. The starting point must always be life, the fact that man is immortal. Man is immortal. We cannot make him so. Through the first three subjects, Mrs. Eddy makes it plain that man or creation originates in mind, is wholly spiritual, and is always immortal. Now, this completely contradicts the theories of natural science, as you know. Therefore, in her fourth subject, she deals with the question of what should be our authority, and explains that the science of creation can only be interpreted from the standpoint of divine principle. Mrs. Eddy makes the divine principle her authority, and deduces from this principle the science of creation. On the other hand, natural scientists start from a material standpoint, and their interpretations of creation must therefore naturally differ from that of Christian science. But as Mrs. Eddy quite rightly points out, the proof of the correctness of her interpretation lies in the fact that her science is not a mere theory, but can be practically demonstrated in every walk of life. In the fifth subject, Mrs. Eddy shows that life is infinite, not embryonic. Life. She stresses the fact that life is, and that life always exists in its fullness. Hence, it repudiates the belief that life has a starting point in a germinating speck or embryo. Life's starting point is infinity, being itself. Life rejects and discards the belief that the great first cause can become material and then evolve materially. The theories of natural science claim life to maintain and propagate itself through various material methods of reproduction, that is, through eggs, buds, self-division, and so on, built as they are on the belief that life has a starting point and propagates itself materially by linking one stage of evolution with the next. It is not surprising that these theories propagate the belief of heredity, the belief that ancestral peculiarities are transmitted from generation to generation. All these beliefs of embryonic life are set at naught by the fact taught by Christian Science that God, life, is infinite, and that life preserves the individuality and identity of its own creation, always in its fullness. Life has no starting point. Life just is, and therefore creation is. The sixth subject depicts that immortal consciousness is man. That mortal consciousness constitutes a mortal, truth. Life is the only origin of man, and so we learn here that the consciousness of this immortal origin is the source of immortal manhood. The consciousness of life, the truth of being, is seen to constitute health, the standard of man, while belief in any other origin constitutes mortal consciousness, mortal man. As Mrs. Eddy points out, the origin of mortals is mortal mind, error, a lie, the very source of sickness. Hence, mortal consciousness is sickness. Having no real origin, however, mortal consciousness is justly declared to be an empty concept, to have no being, to be lifeless. Finally, the seventh subject explains that God and creation coexist, love. Here we get again the great statement that God is self-existent and eternal, that man and his creator coexist. This subject somehow advises us to remain and abide in the fact that life is, that creation is, that any theorizing about the origin of life only alienates us from God, from heaven, from our original state of being. It is as if Mrs. Eddy would say here, you are the manifestation of being, so be. Mind spake and it was done, so let us not interfere with being. The great message of this whole third part is that unless we start with life, we have no life. Life alone can generate life, can bring forth life, can evolve life. Life is the only creator, and because it holds all the faculties of life within itself, it is self-contained and self-existent. Matter is denied any life-giving and life-preserving faculties. This third part says, in short, life is mind, and therefore life's creation is produced by mind. Matter cannot produce life. Life is spirit, and therefore life's creation is always spiritual, the likeness of spirit. It is never material. Life is soul, and therefore life's creation is always immortal. Mortal life can never be, nor can ever be made, immortal. Life is principle, and therefore life's creation can only be stated and understood from principle, never from a material standpoint. Life is life, and therefore life's creation is and maintains itself. There is no life in matter. Nor are there any methods of reproduction through matter. Life is truth, and therefore life's creation is always conscious of itself. Mortal consciousness has no real existence, because it is not conscious of life. Life is love, and therefore life's creation abides in life. It is erroneous thought that forsakes God and seeks an existence outside Him. We get here a wonderful sense that life is self-existent, that life is sufficient in itself, that life is self-producing, self-unfolding, self-preserving, self-expressing, self-maintaining, self-conscious. and self-content. Hence, being is, and this fact is the only cause. Let us now go back over the whole chapter and pick up its main thread again. Genesis gives an exquisite illustration of the motherhood of God, the motherhood of God which embraces not only motherhood, love, but also sonship, truth, and fatherhood, life. As shown in its definition, mother includes the synonymous terms, principle, life, truth, and love. The motherhood of God is depicted in this chapter as the one infinite principle, including within itself the generation of its own infinite idea. Within the womb of God, Mother, there is a forever ordered unfoldment of ideas taking place. Principle interprets to itself what it contains, and it does it through scientific order. This interpretation is presented here in Genesis as creation viewed in the light of mother, son, and father. We therefore have as a predominant theme of the first part, love and mind, of the second part, truth and mind, and of the third part, life and mind. The first part, characterized by love and mind, depicts love including its own perfect creation, the infinite self-containment, within which there is a genesis of ideas forever taking place in mathematical order. The second part, characterized by truth and mind, reveals that through this inclusion and revelation of all-pervading perfection, error's creation is always excluded. The third part, characterized by life and mind, declares, therefore, that there is only one creation, life's creation. Can you feel how throughout these three parts there is a tone of there being just one infinite, self-complete principle expressing all in and of itself? If we apply this chapter to our true being, it teaches us that as principle's idea, our true being is always embedded in the matrix of immortality, is always within the infinite perfection of God. This means that as principle's idea, our true being constantly generates in the order of the science of creation, constantly being conceived anew and evolved into completion. First part. Further, we see that as the outgrowth of God's infinite self-containment, our true being is never part of any false creation, that it lives and moves and has its being in a creation which excludes false creation. Second part. Then we have the tremendous comfort that as principle's idea, our true being is, because it is life sustained, life maintained, life supported, life provided, and life preserved. Third part. This brings me to a point that I have been longing to mention ever since I touched the science chapters. You remember that in the chapter Teaching Christian Science, the student is taught how to become a scientist, how to be principle's idea. Its level, therefore, is really that of Christian Science. because science there is applied to the human, explaining how to get rid of the human concept and how to conform to the divine principle and its rules. Then in the following chapter, Recapitulation, the level is that of absolute Christian Science. You will recall how Mrs. Eddy states in her introductory paragraph that absolute Christian Science pervades the statements of Recapitulation. Why? Well, what we find there is that the one principle expounds and expresses itself through infinite classifications and categories of metaphysics, through scientific metaphysics. In Genesis, thought is then led even higher to the level of divine science. Let me quote how John W. Dorley describes divine science. He says, in divine science, thought is always from the standpoint of divine principle. Divine science is understood only as spiritual sense realizes that there is one infinite being, one principle, eternally conscious of itself as life, as truth, and as love. Furthermore, he says, in divine science, there is one infinite principle, including within itself the divine ideal or Christ, John W. Dorley, The Pure Science of Christian Science, 2nd edition, pages 25 and 28.